coming up on TechNation, some surprising recommendations for the UK's National Health Service. I speak with Sir Andrew Dillon, the CEO of NICE, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. Then on BioTechNation, Professor David Burkholder tells us about impact technology for soldiers in Afghanistan experiencing IEDs and now transitioning to everyday concussive events in sports. And Professor Simon Cherry is working on a whole body scanner to detect and qualify cancer in a single sweep. All this coming up on this week's TechNation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 minutes.
Without getting gruesome here, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety has looked at the numbers and come up with a list of cars that are the safest and a list of cars that are the deadliest. It's hard to believe that the automobile industry threw its weight around to skew the results because everybody took a hit. For every manufacturer, one of its models would score high, while another very low. Still, the statistics are clear. The bigger and more expensive the car, the safer it is. The smaller and lighter, not cheaper, but smaller and lighter a vehicle is, the less safe. I realized right away there could be several red herrings here. For starters, everyone's reaction is a strident, who would buy an unsafe car? But we do. And generally, it's in the context of our projected use and price. I just spent 4 days tooling around a remote Mexican town in a golf cart, and the vehicle fit the setting. And small light cars, which run around small American towns in broad daylight, barely braking 20 miles an hour, don't figure heavily into the fatality statistics here. In other words, these uses don't need an armored vehicle to be safe. On the other hand, let's take that same small, light car and drive it at high speeds on a highway, say 70 miles an hour or more, and let's give the driver a bit of drink, or just a distracted or impatient driver. Well, the results can be deadly, and often for more than just the driver. Another red herring is that the worst cars are not all little cars. On the list was a big pickup truck, with 2 rows of seats from a major American manufacturer. Just the kind that you'd see driving around, with a crew of workers and construction materials in the bed. Or a family on weekends. So a car can look safe and not be safe. While in no world would I be taking my Mexican golf cart out on US 101, what I'm talking about here is the two-edged sword of technology, when financial aspects meet social responsibility, meet consumer demand. When engineers figure out how to solve a problem, the design essentially becomes free. What costs is putting it into vehicles. The more expensive the car, the better and safer designs. The lighter a car is, the less materials go into it. And that's part of why it's less expensive. Of course, we consumers, myself included, want the best of everything for next to nothing, while the auto manufacturers still have to make the budget balance and turn a profit. So what do we do? The good news is that car fatality rates have been plummeting since their high in the 1960s, when Congress passed the Highway Safety Act and car seat belts were mandated. Since then, fatality rates have consistently come down, arguably halved, and better engineering can be directly thanked. But is there a minimum safety we have to engineer to? Or is there room to re-examine our sense that if a car is licensed, it can drive on any road? Should we regulate which cars can use which highways? These days, with zip cars and car share and the like, many of us have a complement of cars available to us. We know that one size doesn't fit all. Now that over half of all Americans live in urban settings, maybe it's time for a change. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancour.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, Sir Andrew Dillon, the CEO of NICE, the UK's National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. He joins us to discuss how health policy is developed and implemented. Then on Biotech Nation, it's all about technology and measuring anything and everything about the human body. From the impact of IEDs on soldiers and concussive impacts in sports, to whole-body PET scanners to detect and qualify cancer. I was able to interview Sir Andrew Dillon in London at the headquarters of NICE, the UK's National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. I asked him to remind everyone about the National Health Service, the NHS, and the role that NICE plays.
Well, most people who live in the UK rely on the NHS for their care. It's funded through general taxation. You can insure yourself privately if you want to. I think about somewhere between 12 and 15% of the population carry some kind of private insurance, normally to allow them to fund elective surgery, so for non-urgent procedures. But for pretty much everything else, for primary care, for chronic care, for end-of-life care, for having your baby, for most of the things that we need healthcare for, most people use the National Health Service. It's been going for more than 60 years now. It is one of the things that people in this country are enormously proud about, and it's a very sensitive issue, practically and politically.
Well, for sure, you just can't fund everything for everybody all the time. And that's usually the nature of what by the time it gets over to us in the U.S., if we're reading something about you or hearing something, it's that you're not funding something that someone wants or however that works. So how do you decide what level of funding to provide for who? What kinds of medical treatments to provide for who?
Well, most people who live in the UK get what they need when they need it from the National Health Service. So we're really, when we're talking about things that the health service can't do, we're really talking about things at the margin. But obviously, health is such a sensitive personal issue that anything that any of us can't get if we think we need it or if somebody's told us it could make a difference is going to be an issue. And that's why it is politically and in the media in this country and, of course, everywhere else in the world. And there are very few of us in the world for whom money is no object when it comes to our health. Clearly, if you're very rich, then it doesn't matter. You can have anything as anybody might suggest could help you if you're not well. But for most of us in most countries, we're relying on judgments that are being made by the system, by the health systems that we're a part of, and obviously by individual health professionals. So we accept that inevitably there will be some limitations on what it is that we can get.
It reminds me of my father's joke. He used to say, what's the difference between a depression and a recession? And a recession is when you lose your job, but a depression is when I lose my job. It's not unlike that.
That's a very important point because when we talk to people about the health service and about what the health service should do, everybody's very concerned that the NHS should be as efficient as possible. It should use its money to get the maximum effect. I mean, that's obviously a logical thing. when they're talking in the abstract. But when we talk about ourselves and our families and what we want, then that concept of a sensible distribution of the money that's available, efficient use of resources, goes right out of the window. We're just concerned to have what might make a difference.
Well, certainly one of the most controversial areas everywhere in the whole world has to do with all the new medical technologies that come down the pike. How do you incorporate that in what's available through the health service?
Well, we do it by starting with the evidence. We look at all the information that's available about what it is that something new does, how it works, what are the patient groups that might benefit from it, what are the risks associated with it. And then once we've assembled all that information, we then have to set it against what we're using at the moment. So what's current standard practice? And what's that additional benefit for patients of introducing something new? What's the incremental therapeutic benefit? That's the most important thing that we have to establish. And it's not always easy, and there's always uncertainty, sometimes quite a lot of uncertainty, at the point at which something new is being introduced. It's all typically based on clinical studies, which are usually done on very highly selective groups of patients. So we don't really know how these treatments will perform in routine practice. But we do our best to establish that. And when we've done that, and this is where, in a sense, NICE is unique in this country and in many respects internationally, we have to make that exquisitely difficult judgment about whether that incremental therapeutic benefit, that extra gain for patients, is worth what the NHS is being asked to pay.
Now, who does the clinical study? Certainly, individual companies have to do it to bring the drugs to market, or treatments to market. But in the case of which studies that NICE may need, is that still the responsibility of the company?
It is, because NICE can't itself fund research. We just don't have the money. That's not our job. So we rely on the work that companies developing new technologies for the NHS do. And we're very keen to, obviously, to make sure that all of the questions that we'd like to have answered can be answered, or at least most of them anyway, given the fact that we're looking at something that's just at the beginning of its therapeutic journey. So one of the things that we do is to offer companies the opportunity to come and talk to us when they're still developing their products. And they can have a conversation with us about the nature of the clinical studies, the sorts of data that we're looking for to enable us to answer that question. Is there additional therapeutic benefit? And is that therapeutic benefit worth the price that we're being asked to pay?
One of the things that is very difficult to understand is that after all the investment of a company to get a product finally to market, they're actually free to charge whatever they would like to charge. And one of the issues that NICE looks at is value for money. Is there any negotiation there with respect to how much something might cost or be charged to the health service?
Well, in the UK, pretty much companies charge what they think the market will bear. And we don't have the power to negotiate with companies. So we can't say, well, look, if you just knock your price down by 10%, 20%, that'll do the trick. We have to accept and use the price that the companies want to pitch their products at. Now, companies with experience of the UK know about NICE. They know how NICE operates. So they'll almost certainly be factoring into their calculations about the price that they can charge, an understanding of how that's likely to play if NICE looks at one of their products. But in the end, we can't sit down with a company in a room somewhere quietly and say, look, let's do a deal over this. That's way outside our remit. We have to wait for the company to make its judgment about price, and then we use that.
And of course, you've already invited them to participate with you much earlier in the process, so that this shouldn't all be a surprise.
No, it shouldn't. NICE is, I believe, a really transparent organization. We're not uncomplicated, and we do accept that. But you can see how the system works, and there is that opportunity through our scientific advice program to come and talk to us, not about how to price the products, but you can come and talk to us about the process we follow, and you can certainly, as a company, come talk to us about your clinical studies program to enable a better understanding of what it is that one of NICE's independent advisory committees might be looking for at the end of the line.
In the United States, when the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, approves a drug for a particular condition, physicians may go ahead and prescribe that drug for that and other conditions. We call that off-label. Does that same thing apply here? If NICE has recommended that, okay, here's the guidance for a particular drug, can the health service go ahead then and prescribe it for other conditions?
Well, individual physicians might well want to explore the therapeutic benefits of a drug for a condition that it's not licensed, and it's legal to do that in this country. They need to agree that with the patient, and they need also to be able to do that in the context of the arrangements that might be in place in the hospital that they work at or the part of the NHS that they're operating in. So it's possible to do it. If NICE has issued guidance, we're issuing guidance where we're confident that for the majority of patients this is the right thing to do. That's not to suggest that all of the patients that it might be indicated for should have it, or that there aren't some patients for whom we've not suggested it would work who could benefit from it. So it's guidance. It's a signal to physicians and to patients that this looks like the right thing to do, given the nature of the condition, given the way in which the new treatment works, and given the resources that the NHS has got available.
How does NICE go about developing those guidances?
Well, we start with the evidence. That's the most important thing.
Just in that corner over there, a bunch of people get together?
No, definitely not in that corner over there. Because
how about over there?
No? Because we don't generate the evidence. We have to do a systematic review. Most of that work's contracted out to academic teams in the UK, sometimes outside the UK. And they assemble a document that is then put in front of one of our independent advisory committees. And it's these committees that formulate the recommendations that you see coming out of NICE. So there are lots of great people employed at NICE, but they never write the guidance. And it's really important that their job is to design the framework that our advisory committees work in. They quality control what they do. They're very much involved in disseminating it and supporting its use in the NHS. But it's those independent advisory committees consisting of people who are working in the NHS, academics who've got evaluative skills, patient representatives, representatives of the life sciences industry, all sitting around the table, all with their different perspectives and ambitions, looking at the evidence, puzzling their way through, trying to reduce the inevitable uncertainty that they're faced with to the point where they can say, this looks like the right thing to do. And they do that unpaid. They get a sandwich for lunch. We pay their rail fares, their traveling expenses in, and their accommodation if they need to stay overnight. But they do it. Not because they get money out of it, but because they are making a contribution to the NHS that they're all committed to.
I think what's so important about what you're describing is that it's not that NICE makes the guidances. We have a whole complement of qualified people, qualified in many different ways, working together to develop these. NICE assembles, if you will, administers this and creates it for the National Health Service. And even then, we go back to the individual physician dealing with the individual patient, that there's leeway there.
Very much so, yeah. NICE, I mean, obviously goes out in NICE's name. We have to explain it and defend it. But it's developed objectively and I think quite robustly by those independent advisory committees. And then, as you say, at the end of the line, we're not forcing patients to take a drug. We're not forcing physicians to make a clinical decision. That relationship is sacrosanct. But it is a relationship that takes place in the context of a collectively funded system. So me as an individual patient, you as a physician, we're having that conversation. We can't imagine that it's just the two of us and nobody else matters. We have to, somewhere in the back of our heads, remember we are part of a broader system that is going to have to fund the decision that we ultimately take.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn. My guest today is Sir Andrew Dillon, the CEO of NICE, the UK's National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. Well, I understand that in the case of straightforward, low-risk pregnancies, that you have evidence, because we've been talking about evidence, that midwife-led units are safer for delivery, for having your baby, than having it in a hospital setting. What evidence do you have, and how do you explain that?
Well, it's probably worth starting by pointing out that there are a small number of countries in the world, the UK, for example, the Netherlands, where midwifery-led care is both accepted and has a long tradition. Midwives are trusted. And although since the 1960s, there's been a shift in the balance between home deliveries and hospital-based deliveries, so that probably since the 1960s, far more women choose to have their babies in hospital. The NHS has always endeavoured to offer women a choice about where they have their babies, and that should be an informed choice. So for whatever reason, a woman should be able to say, I want to have my baby in hospital. But a woman also ought to be able to say, I've had a conversation with my general practitioner or my obstetrician. I'm low risk. I love the idea of having my baby at home. I want that. And so what we wanted to do was to have a look at the evidence to see if we could better inform that choice, not to tell women where to have their babies. Absolutely not the case. Nobody has that responsibility. Women need to be put in a position where they can make that informed choice. And because of the care of women who are having a baby have advanced our knowledge of that, both in terms of midwifery-led care and obstetrician-led care, we're able to be confident in saying that if your risk profile is right for a home birth, and that's a really important thing, because for some women, high-risk women, you just wouldn't want them to choose a home birth, and it wouldn't be the responsible course for anyone to take. But where it's a real choice, then what we know is you're less likely to get an intervention with the risks associated with an intervention if you have your baby at home or in a midwifery-led unit than if you have
like
your baby in hospital.
Like a cesarean, like an episiotomy.
Yes, that's
like
right.
All,
yes.
Of the
all the tech that's there
all
in
that
a hospital.
Technology, darn it. Yeah.
Now, for some women, that's fantastically reassuring. Having that technology there is
essential.
Is what you want. So have your baby in hospital. That's fantastic. But if you don't, if you're comfortable and secure and you're low risk and you want your baby at home, and you should be able to do it, and you can know that your chance of having an intervention with the risks associated with it are lower than if you went into hospital.
Now, in the United States, if you choose to have it at home and you hire a midwife or multiple midwives, that cost is on you, unless you ultimately take yourself and your baby to the hospital or to a physician afterwards. That's it. Is there support from the National Health Service in the case of midwives?
Oh, yes, it's a real choice. It doesn't matter whether you have your baby at home or in hospital, you're not expected to contribute to the cost of that. That's part of the National Health Service.
Now, we usually hear about how you're denying medical treatments. That always makes the news. In some cases, you actually have recommended an increase in medical treatments. And I was actually surprised to see this. One example is a recent recommendation for gastric bypass surgery and other surgical gastric interventions for people who have recently been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. Now, tell us about that.
Well, here's an interesting case where you, where we as an organization have the ability to look over the long term as we're making our recommendations. We all know in the Western world obesity is a problem and it's getting bigger and it's going to get bigger. And we need to do everything we can to support ourselves as individuals, take a look at our lifestyles and to do what we can to help ourselves lead the longest and healthiest life we can. That's going to help minimize the burden on the health system of diseases that are associated with obesity, including diabetes. If we know about diabetes, you know that type 2 diabetes can be prevented, it can be modified by lifestyle changes, particularly diet and exercise. So the first thing we want to do is to try and encourage someone who's in a position, they're overweight, and that have developed type 2 diabetes to introduce those lifestyle changes before their diabetes gets to the point where some of the vascular difficulties.
Point of no return here. We've done a lot of damage.
So let's try and avoid that. Let's see what we can do. And where weight's a contributor to that, we'll want to achieve control. Lifestyle changes. If that's simply not working, if it's just not enough, then gastric banding is a way of helping. And it does help. And we know that. That's what the evidence clearly shows us. And although it's expensive, I don't know, it's probably £5,000 or £6,000, not sure how many dollars that is, probably, you know, $8,000, something like that, for an operation. The payback for the patient, most importantly, can be very considerable, but the payback for the NHS in avoiding those downstream conditions that cost so much to manage is also very considerable.
And the impact on families.
Of course.
It's never just the individual. Something that really helps in health and wellness is the detection of conditions early on, as early as possible. And we're seeing a lot of work in terms of biomarkers. And there are many different biomarkers, and they also include DNA. They include all kinds of things. One example certainly would be Oncotype DX from Genomic Health, which is testing tumors from breast cancer to see how applicable they might be to certain chemo, to see how reactive they might be to particular chemotherapies, how fast-growing, slow-growing they may be. You did take a look at that particular test, right?
We did, yes, and we recommended its introduction into the NHS. Fortunately, at the moment, the NHS has not found it possible to fund that recommendation. This is one of the interesting aspects of the relationship between NICE and the NHS, is that our job is to signal what looks like the right thing to do for patients, taking into account the circumstances that the NHS is in. We can make a judgment about value for money or cost effectiveness, but ultimately the NHS has got to manage within a budget. So although the great majority of the recommendations that we make are ultimately introduced into the NHS, there are some that the NHS finds it difficult to do. Now, I'm confident that over time we will adopt Oncotype DX and other diagnostics that enable more targeted treatment, because it's in the interest of patients and it's also in the interest of the NHS. You're not wasting money on things that aren't the right solution for individual patients. But we have to accept the fact that we can't assume that just because NICE is recommending it, the NHS will automatically and immediately put it into place. That would be nice, but it's probably not realistic.
I'm speaking with Sir Andrew Dillon, the CEO of NICE, the UK's National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of TechNation and BioTechNation are available at technation.podomatic.com, iTunes, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show on BioTechNation, everything about the human body, from the impact of IEDs on soldiers and concussive impacts in sports, to whole-body PET scanners to detect and qualify cancer. Stay with us. Thank you. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Sir Andrew Dillon, the CEO of NICE, the UK's National Institute for Health and Care Excellence.
But we have to accept the fact that we can't assume that just because NICE is recommending it, the NHS will automatically and immediately put it into place. That would be nice, but it's probably not realistic.
But it does point back to the recommendation on gastric bypass. If in fact there wasn't, even though in the long term it will save money, if there wasn't enough money now to implement that, they'd have to hold off on that recommendation.
That's right. And so people might say, well, what's the point in doing this if the NHS isn't going to put it in place? And to which the answer is, well, we need to know what the right thing to do is. And even though the NHS might not be able to introduce it for everybody immediately, what it's done is given the service a push in the right direction.
Well, I got to say, you know, you've been the CEO for 15 years now, since I guess the inception of NICE. And, you really have to develop a thick skin. I mean, I did my research. One columnist at The Guardian offered that you had the passion of a paperclip. I mean, that's tough stuff. I mean, how do you go to work every day when you never know what the news is going to bring with some kind of a, you know, review of yourself and all of NICE?
Oh, passion of a paperclip. That's one of the more charitable descriptions that I've read about through the years. I guess the point behind this is that you do need to be able to, in a sense, separate the individual consequences of the decisions that your organization makes, which are real and profound. I'm always struck when I'm talking on the TV or radio about some decision that NICE has taken recently to restrict access to treatments. It's often questions to me are often followed an interview with a patient who's had access to the treatment or not, and you realize that this is you speaking in another context or a member of your family. And when people say, how do you feel about that? I would say, I feel exactly the same way that individual does. But I have a different job. It's to help the NHS balance the allocation of its resources across all of the things that through our lives we'll expect it to do. And until we get to that happy day when money's no object, it's better that we do it through the objective and transparent and I think pretty robust processes that we've got in place.
You were the chief executive for many years of a hospital. If you were to go back now to be the chief executive again of a hospital, have you a new perspective given the job that you've had?
I don't think I would, no. I think I frequently think about the years when I was a hospital chief executive. That was half of my career. And I remember just how difficult it is to square the circle when you're running an institution employing 6,000 people with hundreds of millions of pounds of budget and thousands of decisions being taken every day that commit the resources that hit the bottom line that ultimately only you are really accountable for. And I remember conversations with physician groups inside the hospital I was responsible for, talking about things they wanted to do, about the costs associated with that, and being frequently struck by the fact that there was very little information to go on. You had the passion of the physicians themselves, which you've absolutely had to acknowledge. Pretty much every case, there's something there for patients that you'd want to do, but how do you balance those things off and get some kind of priority list? So I'd have really appreciated having something like NICE, an organization that we could turn to and say, well, that's where we're going to start. It may not necessarily dictate the decision we take, but at least we'll have that start point. We'll know all there is to know about the potential for this investment to do the things that we want to do for our patients. I mean, I should say, the last thing I want to do is to go back to be a hospital chief executive now. It was difficult enough when I was doing it.
You were afraid you were going to get a lot of cards and letters were going to come in saying, yeah, hey, we have a job for you.
Yeah.
But no. Well, Sir Andrew, thank you so much for joining us. Please come back, talk to us anytime.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much.
My guest today is Sir Andrew Dillon, the CEO of NICE, the UK's National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. More information about NICE can be found on the web at NICE, that's N-I-C-E, nice.org.uk. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation.
The world we know is changing. Welcome to Biotech Nation. Today on Biotech Nation, it's all about technology and the contributions it makes to biometrics, measuring anything and everything about the human body. It's also a tribute to the engineers who build serial number one, and it's about the impact of federal government research dollars, which start the process and end with changing all our lives. One technology today was seeded by the Department of Defense in its effort to assist soldiers who were victims of IEDs, improvised explosive devices, in Iraq and Afghanistan, while the other was spearheaded by the National Institutes for Health to improve the detection and evaluation of cancer throughout the human body. First up is Dr. David Borkholder, the Bausch & Lomb Associate Professor of Microsystems Engineering at the Rochester Institute of Technology. He's also the founder and chief technology officer of Black Box Biometrics, and I was able to speak with him at CES 2015 in Las Vegas, Nevada. DARPA, D-A-R-P-A, is short for the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which commissions advanced research in support of the U.S. Department of Defense. Dr. Borkholder received funding for a DARPA project. I asked him, what did you do?
We had funding from DARPA to develop a blast force sensor for the U.S. military. So this is a soldier-worn device that measures pressure and acceleration forces that are experienced during an explosive blast. So this was really intended to address the growing issue with traumatic brain injury in the military, much of that driven by improvised explosive devices that they were experiencing in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right. So the soldier, we don't know where the soldier is, what's happening, and all of a sudden there is this explosion. What exactly happened here?
That's right. So the soldier's wearing the device. It's constantly monitoring the environment. When there's an event, it analyzes that data, and it provides immediate feedback to the soldier or the field medic with LEDs, so you get an idea of the severity of the event. And then they can download all the detailed data that's captured, which ultimately is going to allow us to better understand how those exposures correlate to both acute and long-term injuries.
Now, you said LEDs. So on the device itself, there's a readout. So you could look at the device right away and get some information.
That's right. You can press a button, and it will illuminate a colored LED, either green, yellow, or red.
Ah, red ain't good.
Red isn't good.
Not good. And I would suspect that you're collecting more information than that, but that's just right on the spot.
That's correct.
How large the force is.
That's correct. You get an idea of how large that the forces were that were experienced by an individual, and then we do have all the detailed pressure and acceleration time-based data that's stored within the device.
You could probably figure out exactly where the explosion was, how far they were away for all the various soldiers. I mean, you could do a computation of the field.
There's been significant work done in recreations of in-theater events where the blast gauge data has been used to validate those simulations. So those are actually three-dimensional hydrodynamic simulations that show what the blast looks like in three dimensions over time. So they get time-based waveforms, just like we capture with the blast gauge, and they can see that those, what they're simulating, matches what we've captured in the blast gauge. So that gives them actually full context of how far away, how large the blast was, and not just what the exposure is at the points we're measuring, but over the entire body.
And it gives us a signature of the blast.
It does. That's exactly right.
Now, would a soldier be wearing multiple gauges or just one?
So they wear three. They wear them on the nape strap of the helmet, on the shoulder, and on the chest. And so there's body shadowing that occurs when the overpressure wave interacts with the body. And so this allows us to get an accurate measure.
You mean body shadowing, make one person standing in front of another?
No, so if the blast were behind me, I would measure a higher pressure on my back than I would on my chest. So this allows us to get an accurate measure of the actual loading that's happening with the soldier.
Now, of course, this was research. You didn't show up and just give them a final product in the field. You had to develop this.
We did. So it was actually an accelerated research program. We had 12 months to field 1,000 devices in Afghanistan. And so we did that in the university, developed the technology from the ground up, developed our algorithms for triggering and data analysis, and actually shipped devices that DARPA fielded in Afghanistan. They worked very well. We unfortunately had soldier exposures when they were wearing gauges, and they functioned as expected, provided really important data. And so DARPA wanted to extend that, and that's when we extend the fielding, and that's when we formed Black Box Biometrics to commercialize the technology.
So you're the chief technology officer of Black Box Biometrics. Of course, you're still a professor, an engineering professor, continuing along. So this research project then became your product called Blast Gauge. And you're selling them to the military.
That's right. So the blast gauge is in use by U.S. military. The Army is fielding it on soldiers deploying to Afghanistan. Special operations are using it. Almost every branch of the U.S. Department of Defense uses the blast gauges for operations and training and research. Also international military. So the Australians had outfitted their soldiers that were in Afghanistan. A number of other countries are using it for their special operations forces. And we also have extended that to law enforcement. So tactical officers, those that do tactical entry, they often are exposed to lower level exposures as they do breaching. So as they're entering buildings, blowing out doors. And so this allows them to understand the exposures that those individuals are experiencing both in training and operations.
And now you come to another application that we're here for today. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So as we were working in the military space in really trying to address the traumatic brain injuries that were occurring there, we saw this emergence of awareness of the concussive threat in sports. A lot of that was driven by publicity around what's happening with the NFL, but also a lot of concern with youth. So we really felt an obligation to take our expertise and technology that we have in measurement of concussive forces, and we created the Lynx IAS, the Impact Assessment System, that is intended for athletes to monitor what the impact exposures are on the head.
And Lynx is LINX.
Correct.
And the IAS is the Impact Assessment System.
Correct.
So is this bigger than a bread box? Not that many people know how big a bread box is anymore.
Right.
Is it a little
so
tiny?
It's about the size of a stick of gum, weighs about the same as a nickel. So it's a very small, flexible device. It fits into a custom headband or skull cap. So it's held firmly against the head so to ensure data accuracy. In that device transmits data directly to an app in real time. So on the sidelines, you get notification of impacts.
On every one of your players.
On every one of your players, that's right.
So you're the whole football team.
Could be the whole football team. It also could be a parent who's monitoring just their child. So it's designed to accommodate both individuals and teams.
So it's the size of a stick of gum. So you have to get it into a helmet or a headband.
So
how do you do that?
So it slips into a custom pocket that's in the headband or skull cap. So we have it in a headband or skull cap, so it's held against the head. That allows us to measure the forces that are experienced by the head. If you put it on the helmet, then you're measuring forces experienced by the helmet, which may be different.
You know, this is so new. It's like you could get a huge amount of data. We almost don't know what to look at this point, do we?
So there's been historic data that's been collected with expensive systems that have been integrated in football helmets. So there's in the literature, there's actually a fair amount of data on level of exposure, so those forces that are experienced, and then diagnosis of concussion. So what we've done is use that data to set thresholds that take this really complex data and try to make it simple for the end user. So we have a color-coded scheme and also a numeric scheme that goes from 1 to 100, green, yellow, red. So if you get a green indication, that's going to go from 1 to 49. And that will give that those are exposures where historically people have not experienced a concussion. Once you get to the yellow level, which is 50 to 69, that's a level where some people have experienced concussions. And at red, which is 70 to 100, more than half of individuals experienced a concussion. So this gives the end user an idea of that severity of impact. Every athlete is going to be different, so the device doesn't diagnose a concussion, but it does give you an objective measure of the impact.
The difference now in thinking compared to what it was, say, 20, 30 years ago, was that it used to be, was it severe enough to cause a concussion? And today we're looking at an accumulation of very low-level traumas that end up adding up to a concussion. Is that right?
So it could be cumulative subconcussive hits. There's been some very recent research that has looked at changes in the brain associated with those accumulated hits over a season. So I think people don't fully understand what the long-term implications of that would be, but it's certainly an area that we're concerned about. So we capture the total number of hits, but you're also worried about identifying those individuals that had a singular hit where they may be at risk of concussion. So often concussions won't have visible signs, and sometimes symptoms are delayed. So this technology helps you identify those individuals that have received significant impacts, and that helps you make better decisions about that athlete. Can also help you to tune training. It can also help you tune athletic technique. So if they're training and you're seeing high levels of impacts, this technology allows you to identify that, and you may be able to change behaviors to reduce the level of impacts that they're experiencing, overall making the game safer to play.
This is one of these areas where we're suddenly going to get all this information, and that's going to change a lot of things. Now that we have this, we're going to get information. It's going to change our perspective about how we're doing things.
Absolutely. The data is going to be incredibly valuable. It's going to give us a lot more knowledge about what our athletes at all ages are experiencing. And I think that ultimately it's going to enable us to make the game safer to play and have those athletes playing longer.
Now, we started with a research project. Now we're talking about a product downstream here that's real. In fact, you came to CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, and you won one of the CES 2015 Innovation Awards. In fact, you won three of them. Tell us about these awards. I think that's unprecedented.
Yeah, we're really honored to be recognized in three categories. So it was fitness, sports, and biotech, tech for a better world, and wearable technology. So I think this really speaks to the advanced technology that we've built into Lynx IAS and to the real need for this product.
Dr. David Borkholder is the Bausch & Lomb Associate Professor of Microsystems Engineering at the Rochester Institute of Technology. He is founder and CTO of Black Box Biometrics. More information about its Lynx Impact Assessment System to record and process individual concussive impacts in sports can be found at lynxias.com. That's LINX, Lynx IAS, lynxias.com. Many people with cancer have received PET scans. These scans are focused on the particular areas in the body in which cancer is present or suspected. Yet cancer can spread and be present throughout the body. Dr. Simon Cherry is a professor of biomedical engineering and radiology at UC Davis. The National Institutes of Health and UC Davis itself has funded Dr. Cherry to examine the feasibility of building a whole-body PET scanner to view the cancer present everywhere in a single scan. I started out by asking Dr. Cherry, what exactly is a PET scan?
A PET scanner is an imaging device that's quite widely used in the clinic these days. There are about 2 million PET scans performed in the United States each year. primarily for cancer right now, for staging cancers to see if the cancer has spread. And the current scanners only cover a small part of the body at any one time. And so to view the whole body, the patient is stepped through the scanner step by step to build up a picture of the whole body. The reason that that's very inefficient is that we're wasting the signal that's coming from the parts of the body that are not in the scanner when we're imaging. And that signal is contributing.
And all of these things are important. What's going on at the same time in the body?
Well, for example, in cancer, yes, you don't necessarily know where the cancer has spread. Or another application might be if you're looking at stem cells and you're looking at a new therapy involving stem cells and you want to know where those stem cells are in the body. So there are many applications where you need to look at the whole body to understand what's going on. And so the idea of this total body PET scanner is to allow us to image the entire body simultaneously, collect the maximum possible signal for the minimal possible radiation dose.
Now, most people are familiar with what X-rays of their very own body look like. Almost everyone has had them taken. What's the output of a PET scanner?
All right, so let me back up and just explain a little bit about how PET works. So in PET, it's a little different than X-rays. With X-rays, we shine X-rays through the body, and then we measure the X-rays that are transmitted through the body. In PET, we actually put the radiation source inside the body. We inject a tiny trace amount of a radioactive molecule that we inject intravenously usually. That distributes in the body, and typically it's designed to find a specific target inside the body. And so we can actually image the biology of the body with PET, whereas X-rays tend to image just the structure of the body. So it's giving us very different information than X-rays. So it's giving us more functional, sometimes we call it molecular information.
So let me just say, if I understand, when I see an X-ray of myself, I'll see like my whole rib cage. I'll see the bones and I'll see some shadows of what you could see sort of the rest of me. But you're primarily seeing bones, if you will, and how they all fit together.
That's right.
In this case, you're injecting something with some radioactive, fluorescence to it, or just radioactivity to it.
Yes.
And it's attached, specifically attached to molecules within your body. So you inject it in, it flows through your whole body, it gets there, and when it attaches to places, that radioactivity is there, and you can see it.
We can image it with
the PET scanner.
Yes, the most common example is to label a sugar, a form of glucose, with a radioactive tag, and we inject that in, and that gives us pictures that reflect glucose metabolism in the body, so how the body is using sugar. And that's important because, for example, in diseases like cancer, where the cells are rapidly dividing, they have a high demand for this radioactive sugar, and so they accumulate it. And so we see
cancer cells want sugar.
Yeah, so we see an increased signal where there are cancer cells, and that's why PET scanning is used in cancer so widely. And in some of the neurodegenerative diseases, it's the opposite thing that happens. So brain cells are not so avidly using the glucose, and you see a decrease in signal. So that's one example where we radioactively label glucose, but there are many other compounds that have been labeled and used to study different types of molecules inside the body.
Is this dangerous?
No.
If the answer was yes, I'm not sure what my next question would be.
Yes, no. There is a radiation dose associated with a PET scan, but it's a very small dose. It's roughly equivalent to the dose that we get from just the natural radioactive background on the planet that we would get in 2 or 3 years, something like that. So we would get about that much dose from a traditional PET scan. But with the total body PET scanner that we're trying to design right now, we'd reduce that by about a factor of 40. And then you would be getting a radiation dose that's about the same additional dose you would get in flying from the west coast of the United States to Europe and back. Because when you're flying, you're at high altitude and you get a slightly increased radiation exposure. And nobody really worries too much about that tiny little extra amount of radiation you get on a plane when you travel. And that's the amount you'd be getting with our new scanner if we can design the scanner.
So right now you're funded to do a feasibility study. You're probably putting things together.
Correct.
And you're engineers. So you
yes.
say, can this go to that? And what would be completely new? And what could we do off the shelf? And
yes, we're prototyping all the components, the detectors, the electronics, all the algorithms to handle the data, because there's been masses of data from this scanner, because it's a huge scanner
it's
with many sensors.
It's not just building it. It's like the data can't come out and fall on the floor.
That's right.
Which would be very bad result.
Yes. So there's lots of interesting challenges, lots of scientific challenges, lots of engineering challenges, but we're well on the way now to showing the feasibility of this project.
Well, at this point, you must have some sense for how much this is going to cost to build and how much it's going to cost to operate.
Yeah, so the building the first prototype is always, quite expensive, as you can imagine. And so our estimates are that to build the first prototype will cost about $12 million. That's not out of line with other very high-end imaging instrumentation that's been developed, such as high-field magnetic resonance imaging or MRI scanners that have been developed. And that's not to say that that would be the ultimate cost of a product based on this technology, because obviously when you go into manufacturing, you have some economies of scale and certain costs could easily come down. But still, that would put it in a ballpark where it'd be pretty expensive to be used routinely in the clinic. But initially, the goal would be to explore research roles and have perhaps a small number of these scanners installed at the major medical research centers in the country to really understand how it helps us see things that we've never been able to see before. And from that, hopefully, clinical roles will emerge.
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of researchers out there that just can't wait until you have this in place, right?
Yes, there's a lot of excitement in the field about this. We've had a lot of support from our clinical colleagues who'd be very interested to see this technology developed, and growing interest also from the medical imaging companies as well.
Would you do some research on it yourself?
Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, yes. Let's yes. hear about that, Simon.
I mean there's many things we would love to do. So at UC Davis, we have a big program in regenerative medicine and stem cell therapies, and so certainly that's an area we'd be very interested in exploring. I'm also very interested in exploring these very low-dose applications and seeing if we can really apply PET in populations that have not been able to benefit from that technology so far.
Okay, brand new, serial number one, risk. What's the risk here? Where are the risk? What are the portions of the system where it can be risky to put together? And we won't tell the NIH or UC Davis.
No, that's okay. Actually a very good question, and it's one thing we have to, and we are being very careful about, is to balance innovation and risk. So we're actually using fairly conventional detector technology, tried and tested approaches, because we're scaling up to such a scale here that we can't afford any of the components to have failures. And so academics are not known for being very risk averse, but in this case, we are being very careful to use technologies that are tried and tested, and to be very careful in how we design and finally assemble the scanner to make sure that it will work. Because the most important thing for prototype one is that it works, so we can do the interesting science we want to do. If it's successful, I'm sure there'll be many generations of scanners beyond that that will use more advanced technologies.
Well, let's
number
just
one
concentrate.
Has to work.
Serial number one.
That's right.
Simon, good luck to you. Please come back. Let us know how it goes.
Will do. Thank you very much.
Dr. Simon Cherry is a professor of biomedical engineering and radiology at the University of California, Davis. Once again, for information concerning LINX-IAS, the impact assessment system providing the ability for real-time feedback on potential concussion-causing impacts in sports, can be found at linksias.com. That's Linx, L-I-N-X, linksias.com. For Biotech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos. And audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Muller, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Landcourt.